RJR News Center now presents That's a Wrap, a review of the top stories of the week.
Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Earl Moxham. With me today are regular panelists Martin Henry, Gleena columnist and academic manager at the University of Technology, and attorney at law Clive Monroe Jr. Well, lots of things to talk about today in terms of the news. As always, Jamaica has the habit of making lots of news, and therefore we have much to consider today. And let's start with one which has seen Jamaica's image, and specifically that of the tourism industry, being dealt a major blow last week when USA Today, a respected newspaper, published a detailed report on allegations of a culture of rape in tourist resort areas. The newspaper reported that 78 tourists were raped in Jamaica during the years 2011 to 2017. And some of the alleged assaults were reportedly carried out by hotel employees. The Jamaican government, the police and tourism officials have had very little to say on the matter, while other sections of the private sector have called, for a comprehensive response and follow-up action. So, where do we go from here? Martin Henry, have you heard enough from the authorities?
Well, first of all, I want to say let us not agree with USA Today about a culture of rape. We have a number of documented incidents which are coming to the fore now. I'm not willing to add them up to being a culture of rape. I think the response from the Jamaican authorities has been very tentative and careful. We need to ensure that our guests are safe, especially in the all-inclusives where they are secluded from the rest of the population. And the hotels certainly need to look to their recruitment policies. But more importantly, I notice we have flogged recruitment this past week quite significantly, but we also need to look at the management of work and how workers interact with guests. In some organizations where there are sensitive matters of human relationships, there is a principle of more than one person dealing with a matter, as in medicine and nursing, where doctors are covered with a backstop person present and so on. Rape thrives on isolation and privacy. If we can deal with those matters in the resorts, we should in fact take the steps to do so. One more comment before I cease this introductory remarks. Let us look to the safety of all Jamaican citizens protected by our own government under the circumstances of our lives, and not get overwhelmed with cases of visitor infractions against visitors. I found that the discussion didn't sufficiently talk about the situation facing large numbers of Jamaican young women who are facing rape incidents.
But that report was coming from the perspective of an American newspaper looking out for the interests
of
Americans.
Of the local responses. And also, I'm glad you raised the point, because we must temper the foreign reports with our own realities on the ground. We can understand the American interest. I'm broadening that to consider the Jamaican interest. One, we have to protect the tourist industry by taking appropriate steps, but we also must create a culture of public safety for all the people who are on the rock, whether as visitors or long-term residents and citizens.
Clive, I go back to you with the question of the responses thus far. Martin says tentative. What say you?
I think it is fairly tentative. It has been. The response, I think the formal response was something along the lines of, we abhor all of these incidents wherever they have taken place, and we must respect the rights of citizens, of the visitors. And
we continue to have record visitor arrivals.
Yes. As kind of, you know, that blip on the record when it scratches. Kind of along those lines, not to play up the negative part of it. I would agree with Martin to the extent that I'm not certain that there is perhaps a culture of rape. I would say, though, that I do believe that there is, in a sense, we have to be very careful of a culture of harassment. It started out simply as just, illicit sex tourism, which happens all over the world. But there's a sense in which young men in particular, and even young women in these resorts, they hawk themselves to visitors. And sometimes in a way that is I suppose there's no decent way to do it, but more indecent than normal.
There is this naive, perhaps, view on the part of some Jamaicans who think that visitors arriving here are all coming for one particular reason or a couple of particular reasons. One is for sex, one is for drugs. Mm-hmm. And it is true that some people will come here with that thinking in mind. And in fact, there are some, let's say, Americans or Europeans who think that every Jamaican walks around smoking a spliff, for example.
In a coconut tree.
Yes. So there is misunderstanding on both sides, but there clearly is the need for greater sensitization and to say that everybody who is coming out here is not coming to find back their groove.
No. Costello was one person,
yeah.
Right? It's not for everybody. There may be persons who have that idea. And there's an attraction with these things. People tend to find what they're looking for. But that is not something that should be a wide swathe approach. I think we also have to look at this notion of hospitality and how we look at this. Also, this notion of jobs. To give somebody a job is good, but they also must come and apply to the work what is required in that work. Hospitality requires a certain type of spirit, a certain type of work, so if you go, for example, and you sing a song, if you have sung this song maybe 10 million times, but to the person who is coming today, it's the first time for them. It is great. So you have to do it with that level of professionalism. You have to treat with the guests and the visitors with that level of professionalism as well. And I don't always feel, when I have visited local hotels, that there is that level of professionalism. And so you end up with situations like this. Many of these reports are of people, for example, taking away guests to secluded portions of hotels because they believe that this is what the guests want from them. And that is not a part of their remit as professional workers.
Martin, you are part of the educational services here in Jamaica. And yes, certainly in terms of preparing workers for the industry, that has long been professionalized in terms of formal training institutions. What's going wrong?
I think many things are, in fact, going right. But those trainees come from a certain Jamaican background with certain understandings of human relationships and how to deal with people. It's going to be difficult to eradicate all of those sentiments and feelings. Just to broaden the discussion a little bit, we face the same problems in training security officers, where people want the police and the army and security guards to be substantially different from regular Jamaicans. But having said all of that, though, we have to underscore the point and report to USA Today that in a fairly high crime environment, tourists are extraordinarily safe in Jamaica. There are incidents, and I think our government needs to respond with greater forcefulness to those incidents. For instance, I'm surprised that those rape cases didn't make criminal cases in Jamaica, at least not prominently so that I could have heard about any of these cases passing through the court system. And I wonder if, in fact, they have happened. They are very serious crimes.
Hitherto, however, in respect of the assertion you make in terms of a very low level of crimes against tourists, before this report surfaced, and we did hear, in fact, the U.S. Embassy or the U.S. State Department through its local embassy had made a report or a reference to rapes in Jamaica targeting tourists about a year or so ago. But hitherto, this question of tourists being raped was not part of the narrative. We were saying, just as you have just said, is it therefore that we might be taking comfort in things that we are not quite knowledgeable of, in that it might well be that the reports of crimes against tourists are being somewhat suppressed?
And that's another weak spot. I think a few of the cases which we have heard about, people have complained that law enforcement has not been sufficiently responsive.
And we have not been able to get the police to be forthcoming with us on this.
So now we are stumbling upon really significant problems. If the incidents take place, they certainly must be reported. They must be dealt with speed, especially considering that visitors are short-term in the country. And while we want everyone to have a quick passage through the justice system, by virtue of who they are and their relationship with Jamaica, one would have expected very serious treatment and a fast track of their matters. So we wait for better particulars. As usual, media excitement tends to fog the discussions. But where we have incidents, we must deal with them in a forthright manner and continue to keep our tourists safe. But I want to go back to the first point that I make. This has to be part of a far larger plan for public safety for all the people who come in and all the people who reside here. I find that our efforts to isolate particular criminal incidents and particular categories to be a poor public safety approach. In other places, tourists mix freely with the population. I have gone to places where I wander about on beaches and nobody knows if I am a tourist or I live there. We wander into shopping malls and eat street food, and we are at home wherever we spend our money to be a tourist in. That's not the case in Jamaica for a multiplicity of reasons, and I think we need to deal with that fundamental problem.
Yes, address those reasons. Clive, I want to switch very quickly before we go to the break to another matter emerging in the Caribbean, that of referenda on the question of the UK-based Privy Council and whether we should switch from that to the CCJ, the Caribbean Court of Justice, as our final appellate court. I think St. Vincent and the Grenadines is contemplating doing that again. Grenada started the process on Friday where the security forces or the police voted in that referendum on Friday, and on Tuesday the rest of the population will vote. It was only 2 years ago that they had the first referendum on the matter. They had questions relating to that and six others, and they did not secure the two-thirds majority required on any of them. I don't know how far sentiments have shifted since. You know, have a situation where one political party dominates everything. First of all, your thoughts on what the outcome might be on this particular issue. And second, do you see the winds shifting in favor of more countries joining the appellate division of the CCJ?
Well, it's up to the will of the people. So the people have to decide as to whether or not they feel that that is the way forward. I think the problem with the discourse, and it has been throughout the Caribbean, is that it tends to fall into an issue of politics. So the issue, which to my mind is largely a standalone issue, it tends to become shrouded or enveloped in issues in relation to whether or not you believe in regionalism or whether or not you like a particular government or administration of the day. So it almost becomes a referendum on the administration, but not necessarily on the substantive issue.
And parties in power tend to be in favor of it and in opposition against it.
Yes, 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 at the same time. Sometimes at the same time. And so, to me, I think there's definitely a willingness by the Privy Council to be rid of us. That is certain. The question is whether there is a willingness by us to join the CCJ, which is a different question.
Martin, quick word from you.
I make two fundamental points consistently. This discussion has come up over and over again. One, there is no reason why sovereign states, however small, should not have their final appellate court.
Domestically?
Yes. And I think Jamaica has a very good case for a final appellate court on those grounds. Two, I am far more interested in justice on the ground at the level of the parish courts than I am in the final appeals court. We have made a shambles of basic justice on the ground where there are hundreds of thousands of cases jamming the system and people are incarcerated for years without trial. That, I think, is where our biggest energy and focus should be, rather than wrestling with who makes 20 decisions about final appeals in the system.
Yeah, but on that point, Claire, very quickly, when it comes to important constitutional matters concerning your rights, you really have to make sure that your system beyond the parish court is well structured.
With great respect, and I don't disagree with Martin as to the importance of doing it at a grassroots level all the way up. That is important for justice. But at the same time, I don't see the two issues as being so entwined that one cannot be looked at separately from the other. When you're dealing with very large issues that affect the entire population and they go the full breadth of the judicial system, it is important who your final court is. That was the point that was made in the Seringa Marshall Burnett case, and that the people should have the option to choose what that court should be.
Hence my first point. Sovereignty requires that we have an arrangement for final appellate decision.
But sovereignty is to be put to the will of the people.
And that's the final word on the matter, because we go to our first break on That's a Wrap.
Listen to RGR 94FM's Two Live Crew every Monday, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for your chance to win cool prizes courtesy of The Star. We will be asking you a question found only in that day's copy of The Star. Grab your copy and get ready for the question of the day. The Star, the People's Paper. 94FM, Radio RJR.
Ready. And we're back for our second segment on That's a Wrap. I'm Earl Moxham. Still have in studio with me Clive Monroe Jr. and Martin Henry. Now, the perennial ganja debate is on the front burner again following a public forum staged by the RJR Gleaner Group last week. The forum threw the spotlight on several related issues. The slow pace at which full commercialization of the ganja potential is taking place. Barriers to entry for small producers. Challenges to local financial institutions which have necessary correspondent banking relationships with U.S. banks, which are prohibited under that country's federal laws from accepting the proceeds of the ganja trade. And of course, Jamaica's international treaty obligations, which still restrict some of the country's options in how it goes about developing a ganja-based industry. On that last issue, here's how former Justice Minister Mark Golding, who is now an opposition MP, suggested the treaty issue should be dealt with.
If we want to fully legalize, we'd have to withdraw from the treaty. And that's an option. We could withdraw from the treaty. The treaty itself, the law of treaties, the Vienna law of treaties, provides, for example, where groups of countries that are like-minded can form their own treaties around the subject. I think we should be exploring, talking to Canada, talking to Uruguay and other states that we might be minded to have a more liberal regime than what this 1961 convention allows, and designing a treaty for countries that want to have a regime that meets the needs of their people. I think we should be looking at that. Yeah.
Former Justice Minister Mark Golding speaking with host Dion Jackson Miller during last week's forum on the ganja industry. Clive, a smaller treaty grouping. Practical?
Progressive in thought. Practical, probably not, but not for that reason. It's probably because of the consequence of it. The truth of it is that the U.S. can leave out of TPP and out of and renegotiate NAFTA because of its sheer economic size and power. And the correspondent bank issue for us within this region, especially as Jamaicans, is that we have to do most of our banking, if not all of our correspondent banking, through the United States.
And having a smaller treaty grouping would not obviate the need,
no,
the obligation to still engage with those U.S. banks.
Well, not just not engage with those banks, but not engage with those banks on other issues,
yes,
that are salient to us. So we could, in theory, withdraw from the single convention on narcotics. But of course, that would have knock-on effects as to how we share information with our other partners within the region and so on, especially on other drugs that are classified within that convention. But really, the bigger issue is the knock-on effect about the reputation and the money laundering and the corruption and the proceeds of crime. Because if you go through this smaller treaty grouping, that's fine. But the United States, for example, could still say, well, we still believe that some of this is illegal, so we're going to put pressure on your national banks because of their correspondent relationship with us for simply, say, wiring money to do legitimate business.
Yeah.
So we still have that consequential problem. And we've had it before within the last 10 years. We had it during the Dudu saga, and we've had it with scamming. So it is not that this is off the radar. It is a continuous thing between our local banks and their correspondent banks.
Martin?
There are two other pieces of news, Earl, which we perhaps should put into the mix. Canada is short on supply of recreational marijuana. Having legalized, they're running out of supplies. And Uruguay, the first to legalize, has hit the skids in terms of external trade and banking for the marijuana trade. The ganja industry, to use a Jamaican term, is up against a major international barrier in banking. We are now coming to realize that a few people and a few countries run the banking system of the world. If you're not in their good books, it's going to be a huge problem to get around banking transactions. We're going to have to do wheelbarrows of cash in exchange for wheelbarrows of ganja if we're going to do this trading business or get the system to change its stance on the ganja trade.
Well, happily, I have somebody on the phone who might have some answers to that conundrum for us, the very real problem of international banking restrictions. Some of you may have seen and heard the president of the Jamaica Bankers Association maintaining at the forum that there was no getting around the restrictions at the moment. But could there be a way? Economist Dr. Andre Horton believes there is, and he joins us now. Dr. Horton, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Earl. Everyone. No, Earl, the whole issue of banking is a real issue. So say, for example, NTB, who has a correspondent bank, for example, New York Mellon, and they want legitimate transactions to go to the Middle East or to Europe in a specific amount of time, then they would use them as an intermediary. Now, with that said, the others on the panel are really correct to say that the legislation and the proceeds from crime and money laundering and these things have an impact on how they view the cannabis industry. But more recently, blockchain technology and the use of cryptocurrency now mitigate the relevance of say, these commercial banks and so on and so forth. So we have to think outside of the box. We have to think about how best we can have those monies being used to fuel domestic growth and domestic output. I think probably we could see the whole idea of probably the international money or the international movement of the domestic currency at the moment forces us now to look at more local solutions to our local problems. And it's important for us to realize that now we have an illegal industry that we must understand how to expand and or to legitimize, so to speak. And we must therefore look at how we can spend most of those money domestically among ourselves and then look at strategies to get those money circulating domestically to boost productivity, to boost production straight across the board.
Right.
There are lots of linkages tied to farming and agriculture, backward and forward linkages. The idea is this. If countries have legalized, for example, Canada, and their companies are how many times the size as Jamaican companies, but they have legalized, and their companies on the stock exchange, how did they get there? In the New York, there are companies on the stock exchange. You following? Mm-hmm. No, for you to be on the stock exchange, there must be some form of electronic transaction taking place. You're telling me, okay, you have $2 million in your warehouse store, but people are buying stock in what? Where does that stock money come from that people used to buy stock in a ganja company?
Pause there for me, though. Let's take several of the issues you have raised one by one. Many Jamaicans do not understand sufficiently, and I certainly don't either understand sufficiently the blockchain approach and cryptocurrency, how you could use that as an option for our ganja industry.
Yeah, it's the blockchain technology is for what we call smart contract between parties. So it doesn't matter where you are. So whatever transactions you want the money to conduct, or whatever store of value you want the money to conduct, then if you have the raw cash and you use the raw cash to purchase a cryptocurrency, then you use that currency to make the transfer and the trade with whoever. And then on the back end, you cash it out back to cash again, or whatever the case.
And that completely avoids the correspondent banking obligation?
Completely. All intermediaries, including the relegation of a particular central bank that may be the overarching country bank.
What would Jamaica need to do from a regulatory perspective to make this a possibility or a reality here in Jamaica?
Well, that would be a legal standpoint. So that is not my issue to figure out. That's for the lawyers to figure out how best they are going to make. But from my standpoint, the legislation now has room for leverage, but it's just how it is being negotiated. So, for example, even how things are being cultivated, how the value that's being placed on it and how the initiative is being distributed across the island, it could have been negotiated better. We could have been more lenient with, for example, look at the St. Kitts is giving amnesty to everyone who was a farmer now can grow legally, you know, so We have to look at it to say, what is the real objective of what we're trying to achieve?
Right.
Are we trying to minimize crime? Are we trying to increase economic activity, or are we trying to mimic a particular function that might not be the best suitable for our domestic condition?
All right. Let me take you back to the question of the circulation of real cash within the domestic market, because I think that's part of what you were saying a while ago, that you can circulate the cash within the domestic market as much as possible. Again, how do you avoid the banking system?
Yeah, man, remember there are templates out there, you know. As I'm saying before, there are people in America who are making millions a day of cannabis.
Like so in Colorado.
For us to find out how do they get around the system, and then let us look at how best to implement something like that here. There are people getting funds from the stock exchange. So there's nobody walking with cash to the stock exchange, to JMMB, and say, I want to buy shares in RJR. Here's cash. It has to flow through a financial channel. Following?
Mm-hmm.
So when we are saying correspondent banking, where, there's cannabis money already in the legitimate financial system. So it's us now to investigate that and then to cross-lay whatever occurrences to say, well, this cash came from those investors there, to the system, this cash is So there are ways, just the investigation and the approach. Do we want to solve a problem? Yes or no? If we don't want to solve it, then we ramble. If we want to solve it, look at the cases that have used it, might not in the same fashion, but in a similar fashion because it's the same industry. Then how did that money get into the system? And then how is that money being dealt with in the system? And you present arguments based on that to defend the objective of what we're trying to achieve.
We've heard from the banks. Would you say that they are too timid?
I mean, remember that they are very small compared to the global scale of things. So it's going to be very difficult for them to really look at their international correspondence and say that we're going to do this. Why? Because the cannabis portfolio is nowhere near their legitimate portfolio. So why would you want to sacrifice your legitimate portfolio for a portfolio that might jeopardize your entire business operation?
So the fault lies not with them then. What do you say of the government?
The government. We have to coordinate. All of us have to coordinate. We have to coordinate. And the coordination, let me tell you something. All right, we were having a discussion about, somebody was talking about hemp. And they said, okay, hemp is not illegal, but hemp, you can grow hemp, hemp is not illegal, but they need a permit to grow hemp. Okay, where you get the permit? The CLA does not have a permit, we call that now, permit plan or permit protocol.
For hemp.
So the CLA know how to go. So it's like, hemp is being discussed, but hemp is even further than ganja.
Yes.
At least ganja have certain liquor things where them template out, you say, all right, you can grow 5 plants in your yard, you can come register for your license, roofs, and there needs to be more. But you understand what I'm saying? It's just dialogue. Everything is just dialogue and talking.
And there's an even wider range of materials and products that you can develop out of hemp. So
yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is this: the too much red tape, bureaucracy, layers on top of layers, and decisions on top of legislations on top of them things. Some of the things are some foolishness. The man them just complicate the things for no reason, no productive activity can take place. It's like a sabotage.
Oh, not a very positive note on which to end, but I want to thank you. You're giving it from your perspective. Thank you so much, Dr. Horton.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. All the best. Economist Dr. Andre Horton. We go to the break. When we come back, we'll pick up on other matters.
Listen to RGR 94FM's Two Live Crew every Monday, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for your chance to win cool prizes courtesy of The Star. We will be asking you a question found only in that day's copy of The Star. Grab your copy and get ready for the question of the day. The Star, the people's paper.
94FM, Radio RGR.
And we're back for a final segment here on That's a Wrap. I'm Earl Mox. I'm still have with me Martin Henry and Clive Monroe Jr. And for much of the last segment, we heard from economist Dr. Andre Horton. I did say when we came back from the break, we would move on to other matters. But no, I need to give my panelists an opportunity to comment on some of what he had to say. Martin, are you? He believes generally, it would seem, that collectively we are being too timid on this matter. Do you agree?
I thought the social scientist was unduly idealistic in his prescriptions. I didn't hear any hard recommendations of how we could proceed. It's a statement of hope rather than a declaration of direction. He has indicated that perhaps cryptocurrency using the blockchain technology might offer a solution. I don't know enough about the cryptocurrency to make a formal comment, but I do know it is not at the moment legal tender in any country in the world. And as part of state arrangements for an industry, one would have to consider that. What I do know from past experience is that the weight of the financial system of the world and the weight of the United States federal government can be directed against small countries which step out of line with their interests. And that worries me quite deeply with the ganja trade. We are not Canada, and I know that Uruguay has faced very serious difficulties with its own industry being a small player, more on our scale than a Canada.
Clive, two things. Let's start with the question of, he said, as far as the cryptocurrency environment is concerned locally, that he would leave it to the legal people to come up with the right regulations. Is this an easy thing to do?
It's not. It's not, because currency and currency trading is kind of like recognizing a country. It's really about what you're prepared to accept. And if you're, especially for us as smaller players, we could go out on a limb and do many of these things, and we could probably do some legitimate transactions. But the knock-on effect would probably be too great for, as he said, the rest of your legitimate portfolio. This is a problem for us in our other banks. If you even look at it, there is one bank in this country whose parent bank is a Canadian bank. And not, as far as I know, not even that bank. Two. Mm-hmm. Two, NCB as well. But Scotia.
No.
Scotia and
RBC.
Where is it? Well, no, it let's stick with Scotia. Yes. CIBC has Canadian original ownership, but not at the moment.
And as far as I know, Scotia is not backing medical marijuana or any marijuana play in the market, because I presume they know that they will have certain issues going on. I do agree with Andre Horton that in terms of how we treat with it within our own markets, as small as we are, we have not yet been progressive enough, active enough within our own market. In terms of our legislation, you hear a lot of speech from many players and stakeholders, but not a lot of internal action.
But, and on another matter, until we fully legalize, mm-hmm. is there the danger of persons engaging in the industry falling on the wrong side of either the Proceeds of Crime Act or the Money Laundering Act?
There remains that danger, because until we fix it, it remains a crime. It is under the Dangerous Drugs Act, that is a crime. But even when we fix it, then you also now have to deal with the issues, transnational issues.
But there are already provisions on exemptions for medical marijuana, etc.
Largely for import, if we're going from a country where someone can prescribe that to come here. But as far as I know, I don't know of us being able to do so except in a country that has a similar legislative framework as we do.
No, but in terms of domestic initiatives, in terms of research and development and production from medical marijuana, isn't that already part of the liberalization process?
But the liberalization process is not general. It is, you mean specifically for Jamaica?
Right.
Yes, of course.
Our market would not allow for an industry to flourish for medical marijuana.
Well, that's the thing.
Right.
That's not going to happen. If we can't export fairly substantially, that's the end of the matter.
Yeah. Right. So it's really just as simple as that. So unless we're able to do business with people who are willing to accept what we are shipping legally and legitimately, then we're going to have no ends of problems with this particular industry.
All right, let's look at another matter in which apparently we're having some problems. The Child Protection and Family Services Agency has revealed that it needs 50 more officers to effectively respond to the volume of cases being placed in the system. The Stacey Ann Hewitt-Lindsay investigations manager at the agency is arguing that the staff shortage has the potential to significantly lengthen the time it takes to attend to serious cases, and that's a serious issue. This follows a Gleaner newspaper report indicating that a 20% increase in the number of cases being reported to the investigators, that there's this 20% increase. The report stated that there were almost 13,000 cases reported to the agency during the period January to September this year. Mrs. Hewitt-Lindsay, speaking Monday on RJR's Beyond the Headlines, said the agency had to implement special measures to make up for the shortfall, but she cautioned that over time it will take a toll on the officers. Is that the understatement of the year, Martin?
It perhaps would qualify as one-off. Which agency in government is not seriously understaffed? We have heard the police, we have heard, name any agency you wish. We write these brilliant legal provisions, set up these agencies, and then starve them of people and resources to get their jobs done. But speaking about the increase in the number of cases reported, though, I always wonder whether these represent increased incidents or increased awareness and reporting, and that will make a significant difference. And the last comment I'd make on the issue is, I think it is tactically a problem to try and separate the protection of one segment of the society from the general well-being of the society at large. We see our children as being particularly vulnerable, and that I agree and I support. We see our disabled as being particularly vulnerable, old people as being particularly vulnerable, and we isolate these segments for special treatment.
Especially flurry of reports about the particular group.
But if we don't deal with the fundamental issue, I've used that word repeatedly on this
program. Like Michael Manley, no.
If we don't deal with the fundamental issue of public safety and maintaining law and order and creating safe zones for our Jamaican citizens, this isolation of vulnerable groups because of the sentiment of the heart will not yield the kind of results that we want. Children are within families, they are within communities, they are within social groups. They can't be pulled out for special treatment as far as their safety and security is concerned.
Clive, 13,000 cases reported since the start of the year. Presumably, a certain percentage of them will enter the justice system or the court system at some point. And we already know how overburdened the system is. This sounds like a very daunting figure.
It is very daunting. I mean, I was aware of the particular figures, but I was aware of that particular crisis. Martin is correct that throughout the broad cross-section of civil service, public service, that there is under-resourcing, because we know that implementation is our primary problem. But in that particular sector, social work, probation officers, those type of persons who respond to this specific issue, it is critically undermanned. There was a report a few months ago that there was only one psychiatrist for the entire island for all of the persons who were in these homes, these places of safety. When I go to court, in those courts, family courts and so on, sometimes it can take a significant amount of time to get back a social report in relation to the welfare of a child. And the reason for that, I don't think, is because of a lack of industry on the part of the social worker, but because there are so many cases and so few of them. And what it requires visits to places where the mother lives, where the father lives, and of course, if you're in a circumstance where the nuclear family has broken down, they might live in different places. So you have to visit one, you have to visit the other, you have to compile data, you have to go to schools, and this is just for one child, the subject of one report.
In your moment of despair, you might be tempted to quote Ernest Smith from a generation ago, "Are we building a nation or are we building a hut?" In respect of the deficit in terms of meeting the needs of Jamaicans for some of the most basic responses that a vibrant citizenry should expect from the state.
Without a doubt. And it goes back to some of the more difficult questions of our politics. For years, it has been bandied about that public sector reform. As I understand, the basic premise of this public sector reform, and the IMF have said so explicitly, that what they want is that many of the workers that we pay, largely, I would think, for the fact that we can spread the joy around come election time, that those persons, we don't need to necessarily employ them when we can employ people like these who can better give value for what we pay them and also give better competition for our skilled laborers, skilled professional and vocational people who are migrating our shores because we can't be competitive in an economic sense, in a financial sense. So unless we have more of these people and focus more, I mean, it won't happen overnight, but to have so few of them is telling, and its impact is obvious. And I don't necessarily agree that you can't segment children or these other persons. And I take the more general point that, yes, Jamaica should be a safer country. But what are they to do? They're a vulnerable sector of the society. And this is mostly separate from the social context itself. This is after the fact. Something has been, a wrong has been committed against them. How do we fix this? One in the social sense, but also in terms of the justice part of it. What do we do about that? And if we can't meet that, then we can't give them the justice that they desire or deserve.
I think I get Martin's point, though, in terms of carving out special categories when you have this vast amount of issues to deal with, whether through this particular agency or another one or through the criminal justice system. If you were able to address the problem in its widest sense, then you wouldn't have so many problems perhaps even emerging in some particular agencies.
Yes, and a critical data point to be placed on the table. 190 public agencies, which the IMF is asking us to reduce as part of managing the labor bill.
But we keep creating new ones, you know.
And we have a list of how many have been created decade by decade, and it's an escalating list. This country doesn't need 190 agencies to conduct public administration. I think some basic thinking has to be done about what is non-negotiable, what can't be done without, because our resources are slim. And we can't feed all of these agencies from the public budget. What does government need to do to ensure that citizens have well-being, have safety, have security, have opportunities, and can advance themselves by seizing these opportunities? They're critical political questions.
Clive?
I don't necessarily disagree, but at the same time, if you have an issue, how do you meet it? And if you are not meeting it properly, especially if we look at justice, certainly from the deterrent perspective, if people feel that they can continue to do things without repercussion, then it also exacerbates the originating problem, the social problem.
So you're right. That issue is the justice issue, the broad issue.
Yeah, but as we are about to close, well, let's not depart without agreeing that if this agency needs 50 more officers to effectively respond to the volume of cases, and we just cited the 13,000 cases reported from January to now, clearly there's a need for a direct response to that particular need.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No doubt
about it.
Clearly
the agency is non-functional as it now stands.
I wouldn't go as far as to say that.
Dysfunctional, perhaps, rather than non-functional.
Perhaps dysfunctional.
Yeah, under-resourced is the word I would use.
But it can't carry out its basic functions.
Just like many things, it is carrying out its functions.
No, it has 13,000 backlog cases.
It is suboptimal. That is a different thing from saying it's non-functional.
Seriously, well, I'm changing it to dysfunctional. Unable to meet its basic obligations.
I'll stick with suboptimal.
I think we have degenerated into a use of English class here. And on that note, we close today. Thanks as always to our panelists, Martin Henry and Clive Monroe Jr. Earlier we also heard from Dr. Andre Horton. Thanks to Derek Wilkes for technical support as well. I'm Earl Moxham, and indeed, that's a wrap.
Join us again next Sunday at 12:15 p.m. for That's a Wrap. That's a Wrap, a product of the RJR News Center.
Number one. For Jamaica-ness. Yo. RJR 94 FM.